This podcast was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team in collaboration with the JCT English team for the Junior Cycle Talks channel.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. In this week's episode, JCT English talked to Irish young adult author Heather O'Gillian. Heather's novel, The Call, has recently been added to the new prescribed text list for Junior Cycle English. In this episode, Heather talks to us about his writing process, the inspiration behind his novel, The Call, and finding the reader in all of us. We hope that you enjoy. Heather, thanks so much for sitting down with me today. Lovely to get this opportunity to chat with you. And I might start with your background.
Sure.
And maybe you might tell me, did you always want to be a writer? And was English one of your favourite subjects at school?
I always wanted to be a writer. That is absolutely true. When I was very small, when I had just learned to write, I remember I must have been about 5 years old, something like that. I drew a stick figure of a man who was running. And underneath I wrote, "This is a man. He is a bad man. Now he is dead." And I think that was my first story. So.
quite a grim opening there. Yeah, and closing to it as well. So I suppose that comes from doodling and creating characters and images. Is that something that informs your process as you start to write and create stories as you move forward?
I'm not a very visual person, funnily enough. Okay. Although this story, The Call, it did start with an image. I was out walking one time, and usually when I'm stuck for inspiration, and I would advise anybody who's stuck for inspiration to think about the thing that they're stuck on as much as they can, and then go for a walk. And walking somehow seems to knock things loose in your head and jam things together that normally wouldn't go together. And then you start coming up with ideas or having conversations as the characters in your head. And one day I was out for a walk, and this image came to me of somebody in a very crowded room just disappearing. All their clothes fall to the ground, which anyone who's read The Call, see, this is something that happens quite frequently in the book. All their clothing falls to the ground, and all the people standing around were suddenly terrified because they knew something awful had happened to that person. They knew that person was dead, basically. So that was the first thing that came to my mind, was just this image. And then, because this is the way I work with things, I had to figure out, where did that person go? What were the people so worried about? And very early on, I came up with the thought, no, they can't be definitely dead. There's no way they're definitely dead. They're probably dead, but they're not definitely dead. Because if it's certain, there's no excitement. There's only excitement if there's a chance, a small chance, that the person will be okay. That's what makes it exciting. That's what makes people bite their fingernails as they're waiting, as they're counting down the time for the person to reappear. The chance that they might be alive. If they know they're dead, they're immediately in mourning. That's it. They might be in shock or whatever, but there is no excitement. So that was the first thing. And then I had to figure out, where were they? What was happening to them? How is it that they might survive this awful thing? How awful should I make it?
So that idea of inspiration, it comes from kind of curiosity. And what might be, or where might something happen or something occur? Do you find that when you're out walking or in nature, are they the main areas where you draw inspiration from? Or do you draw it from simply, as you said, kind of people watching or imagining? Or
when I'm out walking, things tend to get jumbled together. You need to fill your brain with as many things as possible. Books, movies, podcasts, watching the news, all kinds of things. You just fill your brain with stuff, and hopefully there's just a little room there for them to move around as well. But you fill your brain with stuff, and then naturally things will fall together. But there's a classic technique in science fiction, and I'm a big science fiction reader, but there's a classic technique. It's called the what if technique. And so you start by saying, what if people could teleport? Suddenly a new thing came along, maybe a technology or a technique or whatever, and suddenly people were able to teleport from A to B. What would happen? And a real science fiction author, someone who really cares, will start working out all the implications of it. For example, what's going to happen to bus companies, you know, if people can just teleport from A to B? what will happen to the people who have, say, a new form of disability where they can't teleport and everyone else can, and now there are no bus companies? What happens to them? And so on and so on. You think through all the implications for it. What if two people try and teleport into exactly the same spot at the same time? And so on. You got to work it all out. And you end up creating an entire world. Douglas Adams, who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a very funny book if anyone has not read it, he had this alien race that had 50 pairs of arms. And what he said about them was they were the first species in the entire galaxy to invent the roll-on deodorant before the wheel. And it's that. You start off with a strange situation. For example, you've lots of stories about dragons. These massive reptiles flying through the air, blowing fire, enough fire to burn down cities and so on. Are you really going to have knights in armour in the same world as dragons? Because the dragons will just come along and cook them. You're not going to do that. So if you were starting from first principles, you're starting, okay, we have a world where there are dragons. What happens to the people? Probably all their cities are going to be underground, near water. They're going to invent kind of fire retardant materials quite quickly. They're going to have to cooperate, be very cooperative societies rather than individualistic. Otherwise, they're all going to get burnt to a crisp. And so on. So you kind of start, you know, with this idea and you go, what if there were dragons? And then you work your way through and eventually you create an entire world.
Brilliant. When all these ideas are swirling around in your head, do you have any particular way that you like to capture them or to get them onto paper? Or how do you decide between the ideas that are worth following up with and the ideas that you have to go back and edit or redraft? How does that process work for you?
Oh, that's the real question, because there is... So first of all, I'll write them down as soon as I can, as soon as I come up with them. I often have my phone with me and I will, in the middle of a country road or whatever, whip out the phone and write down a few thoughts about it. But the real question, the real difficult question, is how do you decide which idea? Because there are lots and lots of ideas. And when you write a novel, I've written several novels that have not been published, that have not succeeded in getting out into the world. But some of them took me years to write. There are thousands upon thousands of people writing books. What you have to do is write something so good that an editor who's looking to buy a story picks it up and can't not publish it. Everyone's trying to be the best they can be. What I feel is the idea that you eventually start working on has to be something that really excites you. It has to be something that you sit up all night excited about, thinking, oh my God, and then I can add in this bit, and then I can add in that bit, and oh my goodness, this thing can happen. It has to make you really excited, because when you write it down, it's you're putting a great big veil on it, like you're trying to translate the ideas that are in your head onto paper, and it's like putting a few layers of muslin on top, that the person who's reading it is seeing less of it. They have to see just enough to excite them too. That's what you got to do. So you must really love it. There's no point in putting down something you think is pretty good. Drop that one and wait for the one that really excites you.
That's a lovely way of contributing to experiencing reading and writing as this pleasurable activity and something that you can really enjoy, if the idea or what you're reading or what you're writing excites you and it's something that you're really passionate about.
Yeah.
So there are students out there who might be reluctant readers or they might be reluctant writers. Have you any advice for how maybe teachers might motivate them to read or to write or to see reading and writing as an enjoyable activity?
I tend to think myself, I'm not a teacher, so I won't have as much experience as our listeners here. But I do firmly believe that there are no reluctant readers. There are only readers who haven't found what excites them. I was quite lucky. I had some very enjoyable texts when I was in school, but enjoyable to me. Everyone is different. I remember my nephew, I used to buy him books all the time and he never read them. He just never read them. And then one day he was 16 or 17 and I remembered he was a big fan of Manchester United and I bought a book about one of their more famous players and he read it in a night. You've got to let them find the thing that they love, not the thing that we love. Maybe they're just not interested in wizards or pirates or whatever. Maybe they like tennis. Maybe they like arts and crafts. Maybe they like nonfiction. Maybe they're really visual people and what will really get them going is a good graphic novel. It's up to us to give them a variety or to put a variety of stuff in their paths or even take them to the library when they're small and let them go around and pick out the thing they want. I remember reading this article. I'm really sorry, I can't remember who it was about, but it was about a particular illustrator who he would illustrate picture books for authors of picture books, obviously enough. And most of the people who are in the business of buying picture books for publishers tend to be women. And he would write, I'm probably misquoting this, but he found that a lot of the books that had fluffy bunnies and that kind of stuff would be more likely to get published and would be more likely to be sold in shops. Whereas one book he had with lots of engines and wheels and real kind of cliche boy stuff didn't sell very well. But in libraries, it was 50-50 between the fluffy bunny book and the fire engine book or whatever it was, because kids could wander in and pick whatever they wanted. And some of them liked fire engines. That's all there was to it. Some of them liked fluffy bunnies. Most people like fluffy bunnies, as they should. But whatever the kid themselves likes, that's what will get them started.
Would you write every day? Mm. Or is it something that you do a few times a week or less often? Or how often do you engage in the writing process?
I tend to do it a few times a week. One of the books that really helped me out when I was trying to write novels was a book by Stephen King called On Writing. And the thing is, in the same way as every kid likes different types of books, every writer is a different type of writer. And some people really benefit from writing every day. Some people can't stop themselves writing. They've got a scriptural diarrhea, maybe. They just sit there and they will write thousands upon thousands of words every single day. And other people can barely squeeze out 100 words a day. There are many different kinds of writers and will benefit from different methods of writing. But Stephen King's On Writing benefited me. It was exactly the right book for the way I needed to be, because my problem was I was never happy with the beginning. And I kept rewriting the beginning and I never finished a novel. I never got anywhere at all until he told me in this book, listen, Pather, he uses my first name in my head. Listen, Pather, just keep writing and don't look back, because if you look back, you'll never finish. And that's exactly what it was for me. And what he said as well was he writes 2,000 words a day, every day, no exceptions. And if he finishes those 2,000 words in an hour, great. He can go out and do whatever he likes for the rest of the day. If he doesn't finish them by 6 o'clock in the evening, he's got to keep going. And so when I was writing my first novel, The Inferior, I did his approach. I only did 1,000 words a day because I had a job, but I did 1,000 words a day, no excuse at all. And I got to the end of a first draft. And once you have a first draft, it doesn't matter if it takes you months or even years, you can go back and fix it, get it to a point where most things can be fixed. If the initial idea excited you, and the idea behind The Inferior really excited me, if it excites you, then the excitement is in there to be mined to you. Like they say with the famous story of the block of marble, where someone sees a statue in it and someone else just sees a block of marble. How do you get to the statue? Well, you just keep chipping away at it until the statue reveals itself. And your first draft is usually, it depends on the person, but usually a dog's dinner. And you got to go in there and remove the bits of pedigree chum or whatever it is. And eventually you end up with something even Gordon Ramsay might like to eat, you know.
Absolutely. I really like that analogy too. So we'll move on and we'll have a quick chat about your novel, The Call. So it's obviously received a number of accolades, which is fantastic. But more recently, it's been added to the new prescribed text list for Junior Cycle English. So for those that might not be familiar with this text, could you give me a brief overview?
I have a one-liner that I give sometimes, which is, the call is like a Harry Potter where everybody dies. But I don't feel that really explains the story, for example, for a teacher who's wondering if they dare give it to their class or not. The basic idea, it's based on a famous medieval text called Leabhar Gabhála Éireann, which means literally the Book of the Taking of Ireland. And these days it's usually translated as the Book of Conquests or the Book of Invasions. Jim Fitzpatrick has an incredible illustrated version of it. It's quite hard to find now, but amazing illustrations that really excited me as a kid, even though the text was quite difficult. But among many stories, it tells the tale of the Tuatha Dé Danann, the people of the goddess Danu, who used to live in Ireland and who loved it so much they called it the Many-Coloured Land. They just thought it was beautiful and amazing and fantastic. It was taken from them. They were banished, and no one knows where they were banished to exactly. The last line of the Book of Conquest says, the king of the Tuatha Dé Danann led his people under the mounds, these fairy forts we have dotted around the country. So the Irish word for fairy fort is Lis na Sí, or the Irish word for mound is a Sí. And so that's also what we call the people of the mounds. So we call them just the Sí now. It doesn't actually say where they went really in the Book of Conquests, but in the call, because in history, Cromwell didn't invade Ireland and then say, hey, I've invaded your country, I've taken over the whole lot, and we're going to divide the land between us. Why don't you have the best land? No, he didn't say that. What he said to us was to hell or to Connacht. In other words, you go to the worst land. That's where you're going. Or when you have the Trail of Tears, North America, when the white settlers come in and take over North America, they don't give the best land to the defeated Native Americans. No, they send them to terrible places, bad lands and swamps and all that kind of stuff, because they want to keep the good stuff for themselves. And that's what happens. In my view, if the Sí were going to be sent somewhere, it wasn't going to be somewhere lovely like Chiern na n-Og or whatever. They were going to a hellscape, an utter hellscape. And now we modern people who live in Ireland, we're living on their land. This is their land. This used to belong to them. We are living here in a beautiful country, the many-coloured land. It's ours. How are they going to feel? How are they going to feel about us? And because they're functionally immortal in a way, and they're living in this hell for thousands of years, they've gone slightly cuckoo, right? And ordinary revenge isn't enough for them. They want to do really bad things to us. So one of the things they do is they cut Ireland off from the rest of the world, and then they start capturing teenagers, disappear. They arrive in this hellscape where the Sí now live, and the Sí hunt them down for a full day. They arrive there naked. They don't know where they are. Everything in this place is dangerous. And it's no surprise that most of them don't survive. And of course, a country where without its young people are the absolute source of all energy and all ideas and all brilliance and all joy. And a country without that starts aging rapidly, obviously, because there are no young people. And it starts aging in other ways as well. It turns in on itself and it loses its inspiration. And so what's happening in the book, in the call, it starts about 20 years after teenagers have started to get kidnapped, and very few of them survive. The entire resources of the state are now given over to training teenagers for that one day when they will be kidnapped, to try and help them just survive, to just get through it if they can. They have to run for their lives. But the main character of the call is someone who can't run. She had polio as a child. She can't run. And so everyone expects her. They all feel sorry for her all the time. They expect her just to die. And as we'll see, she has no intention of doing that.
Is there a reason why you picked polio?
There is. I did look at several other medical conditions. I basically, as you can tell, I wanted a character who couldn't run. And I'm always interested in all my books and my stories. I'm always interested in the person that other people discount and other people ignore and other people think very little of. I'm always interested in those kind of people. They put them in a box and say, oh, you're useless. So I'm interested in those kind of people. But why polio as opposed to something else? When I was growing up, I knew someone who'd had polio, who had survived it, and who walked the way I imagined Nessa would walk, a really fantastic person. This person was a great guy. I wasn't a big friend of his, but I knew him and had hung out with him a few times and thought he was just a great guy. And Nessa is not as nice as that. She can't afford to be in the world that she's in. But that's why that was the inspiration for that.
What is one thing that you think your audience or your readers should know before they read the novel?
I would think that it's quite an action-packed and also violence-filled book. There's no getting away from it. Violence always has consequences, both in our world and in the world of the book. The young people who survive are quite damaged. Even the ones who survive in perfect physical condition are quite damaged by it. And that is an effect of violence. It's not a video game. It's not I will say, an old-fashioned comic book, because a lot of modern graphic novels do these things very well. It's not a kind of an old-fashioned comic book. It's real and things have consequences. So that is one thing. Another thing I would say is it's a book about exploitation in a way. It comes from, the inspiration is from the Book of Conquests and the Book of Invasions, and it is about the consequences of conquests and invasions, how we Irish people often, with good reason, feel quite aggrieved that we were conquered and colonized. And in fact, there's a quote from Cuilíne Ártí Léire at the start of the book, which kind of sums up that whole process and the whole grief of it and the whole destruction that was wrought on it. So we're quite aggrieved by this, and rightfully. But when we're in positions of power, we tend to do the same thing. You can see that by so many Irish people who went to America and did the same. You know, it's not like that we are only victims. It's not that. There is no such thing as human beings who are only aggressors or only victims. It often depends on the situation you were born into, and a few extraordinary people can overcome that situation they're born into and can be better than it and can teach the rest of us to grow. And so I have a lot of things in that. In spite of all the doom and gloom that I've been, you know, talking about, it is very exciting. It is fun. Fun in the sense that, how can we describe fun? Fun in the sense that you root for certain characters. You want them to survive. I hope that most of the readers will come to love at least some of the characters and will be really rooting for them by the end of the book. And also, I believe it stimulates the imagination of a lot of reluctant readers. We were talking about reluctant readers earlier. I won't say lots, that's an exaggeration, but maybe every few months I'll get an email from some parent delighted that their son is actually reading something. It's usually boys for some reason, even though the main character is a girl, but it's usually boys who were reluctant, just that their son is reading something and enjoying it and is asking them for the next book. So I think it stimulates the imagination. I think it's full of interesting ideas, interesting situations, interesting imagery. I think they're just absorbed by the excitement of the whole thing and by the worry of the whole thing, especially for the main character.
So we might take an extract from the novel if that suits. And I know that you've picked out the opening chapter from it.
Here we go. 4 years ago, the 3 minutes. On her 10th birthday, Nessa overhears an argument in her parents' bedroom. She knows nothing about the 3 minutes yet. How could she? The whole of society is working to keep its children innocent. She plays with dolls. She believes the lies about her brother. And when her parents tuck her into bed at night, her grinning dad, her fussy mam, they show her only love. But now, with 10 candles on a cake in the kitchen behind her, that's all supposed to change. Dad can't know his daughter is right outside the door, and yet he whispers, "We don't need to tell her." He says, she isn't able to run anyway. She's a special case. We could give her a few more years to be our baby. Our baby. Our baby. Nessa bristles at the thought. She's struggling to stand still because, with her twisted legs, she makes quite a racket when she walks. However, once her mam, Agnes, starts sobbing, she decides she's had enough. "Oh, for crumb's sake," she says. "I'm in the hall. I'm coming in, and you two better not be kissing." She means that last part as a joke, but it falls flat. "Come in then," Dad says. He still possesses enough graying hair to cover his scalp. Almost. He's even older than Mam. And on a bad day, Nessa wonders if that's why she was born weak enough to catch polio. Her cousin told her that once, and Nessa often thinks of it. "I know about Santa Claus," she says, walking in, "if that's what this is about. I've known for years already, but..." Agnes starts heaving like she has been punched in the stomach. She shakes hard enough to rattle the bed beneath her. Dad wraps her tight with his long, skinny arms. And for a moment, it's like this hug is the only thing stopping bits of her from flying off. A chill steals up Nessa's spine. She can't know it, but this is the first hint of the fear that will never leave her again, that will ruin her life as it has ruined the life of everybody in the whole country. Now, Dad is crying too. His tears barely show, a hint of moisture about the eyes, his sobs thick as though squeezed through a wad of cloth. Nessa takes a ragged breath. "Whatever it is," she says. And deep inside, a part of her is begging her to shut up, to stop, to turn around. "Whatever it is, I want to know." So they tell her about the 3 minutes and what has happened to her older brother. And she laughs because that's her nature. And the whole situation is absurd. It's one of her dad's stupid pranks. Of course it is. But they keep the horrible story going. And the fear builds up and up inside her until she screams at them, hysterical, horrified. "You're lying. You're lying." She falls, her awkward left leg giving way. For the next 2 days, Nessa refuses to play or to talk. But she's too intelligent not to recognise the truth. The clues have surrounded her for a lifetime already, and only the monstrousness of it, allied to the trusting nature of her now ended childhood, has allowed her not to see it before. She has never asked herself where all the teenagers were, or why she has almost never spoken to anybody who is 17 or 18 or 20. But if she refuses to let the doctors put her to sleep, this is the future. Sometime during her adolescence, the she will come for her as they come these days for everyone. They will hunt her down. And if she fails to outrun them, Nessa will die. On the third day, her twisted legs carry her out of her bedroom. Her eyes are dry. She says, "I'm going to live, and nobody is going to stop me." She believes every word of it. That's it.
Wow. Chapter one. Thank you very much. That was so powerful.
Oh, thank you.
Really atmospheric. It was mesmerizing almost. Thank you very much for that. So we come to my final question. And I suppose in this sense, what advice might you have for anyone who's looking to write, but is nervous to get started or doesn't really know where to begin, but has a passion there and would like to follow it through?
My advice would be absolutely go for it. Absolutely follow it through. I have to say that what happens is you have to accept that, like anything, you're full of talent. But to get that talent down in paper so that what's in your mind goes into somebody else's takes a lot of practice. So the real skill, the real writers are the ones who can get through a long period of training. It's very hard to write something that you're seeing in your head, because when you put it down in paper, you still see the same thing. It doesn't always come across. And it's quite hard then when someone reads it and doesn't understand it. I remember I wrote a short story once upon a time called The Drowner. It's part of my, I do have a podcast of my own called Creepycast. You can look it up, but it's just short stories of mine. And I was so excited by this idea. I thought it was an amazing idea. I thought it was the best short story I'd ever written. I couldn't understand how anyone else couldn't love it. Obviously, there's something really wrong with them if they don't love it, I thought. And I sent it off to several magazines to try and get it published. And everyone came back to me saying, "I don't understand what's happening. I don't get it. I don't see it. And this is from someone who had already published some novels at that stage. So even then, even when you think you've made it as clear can be, there can still be a lot of work. And the real secret is to listen to someone tell you, I'm not getting it, I'm not feeling it, I'm not understanding it. And instead of going to your room and having a nice cry, although you can do that, there's nothing wrong with that. You've got to dry your tears after or whatever it is, pick yourself up, whatever it is, and then think to yourself, okay, they're not getting it. Believe it or not, that is my fault. I'm not explaining it well enough or painting a good enough picture. I've got to work harder to try and get those things across. So that's what I would say.
And that idea of getting feedback from a friend or a peer or somebody that you trust and then acting then on that advice then based on the feedback that you get. Pada, thanks so much for your time today. It's been lovely to sit down with you. And I hope that readers enjoy and get to enjoy more passages from The Call, very similar to the ones that we've enjoyed here today. So thank you for your
time. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, which was created by the Arts and Junior Circle team in collaboration with the JCT English team. To hear more from Junior Circle Talks, search for us on SoundCloud or anywhere you listen to your podcasts.